pumped to finally get a chance to have you on and talk. It's been a while.
It's been a long time. It's been too long. It's really nice to see you, and it's great to hear your voice and to talk to you.
Yeah. So obviously, I met you back at in the great state of Montana at Carroll College, and now you are not at Carroll. You've been at a new position and a school. Do you want to just fill me in on a little bit of background on what you've been up to the last 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, sure. First, thanks. You know, it was so amazing to be able to spend that time with you when you were leading the student government, and to have that early glimpse of your leadership skills, and I really cherish that time that we had together as president and president, and our times to meet, and that was really fantastic. So, since leaving Carroll, I've been at the University of the Incarnate Word for the last, well, this is my fifth year here, and it's a very interesting institution. Very rare to see a Catholic institution with this many health professions. We have nursing, optometry, pharmacy, physical therapy, and a school of osteopathic medicine. Two campuses in Mexico, one in Mexico City, one in Bajio, and a thriving residential campus, and then online programs. And you know, who would have ever imagined? I certainly didn't imagine that when I took this job, I'd be leading during a pandemic. Probably none of us even really was thinking about that possibility. So it's been a really interesting couple of years, for certain. And thankfully, we're doing well, all things considered.
Yeah, the thing that I have always marveled at as I grow in my career and looking at leadership of different levels of leadership, I'm curious, from your perspective, how would you describe the role of a college president? Or you could take it in the direction of an effective or an ineffective president, however you want to break that down.
I think it's really difficult to describe the role of a president to most. And even having spent time, a lot of time very close and traveling the world with a president who was my mentor at St. Edward's University and Dr. George Martin, you think that you understand what's happening, what that role is like, all the things that are involved. But then once you are in the role, it's really difficult, I think, for others to understand how much happens in a day. And certainly, throughout the course of a week, how many phone calls, how many emails, how many things coming from all different directions. It's exhilarating. It's full of highs and lows and a lot in between every single day. And I think one of the things that is really required in this role is a lot of stamina, given that it really does kind of feel like a 24/7. 365 type of position. And I think what generally makes for an effective president in higher education in the United States is actually a real adherence to and appreciation for shared governance, because it's very different, I think, than a lot of leadership positions that where I think a lot of people, they say, well, you're the boss, you can do whatever you want to do. And That may be true in some cases. In most cases, it's not, because you're spending a lot of time with other people, gaining consensus. You're getting others' feedback. You're in leading. You're trying to also instill a certain amount of support in all the different groups to try to move in new directions or different directions, or even to keep doing what we're doing. Presidential leadership conference that I was at, they described the role of a president as absorbing chaos, inspiring confidence, and restoring order. And I think that actually is a very good description of what a president does in their role. There is a lot of chaos to absorb, and you put a pandemic in there certainly is a lot. And I think that's, doesn't matter which institution it is, but inspiring confidence, I think, is very important, because you are trying to lead in a vision, leading an institution in a certain direction, and others want to know where are we going, and can we trust that it's going to be the right place to go, and then restoring order. Sometimes that assumes that there's order to be restored in the first place, but a lot of it is trying to make sure that things are organized in such a way. Whether that's with human resources structurally, or physical resources.
One of the things that I observed in my time at Carroll, so I was a junior when they were, I'm trying to remember if it was actually my sophomore year that they that you were interviewing. This would have been 2013 is when I graduated. So what was your first year, 2011 or 2012?
I think 2012 was my first full year.
Yeah, and you were like in visiting the campus probably my junior year in the interview process and all that, right?
But I think that's
my
correct.
Perspective was, after like seeing you come to Carroll, it's not like Carroll was struggling necessarily, but it was shortly after you came in, there was this like excitement of like stuff's happening, and there's and this is probably tied into that inspiring confidence thing that you're talking about. But from my perspective, that's probably one of the biggest things, and it looks like you've been able to accomplish some similar initiatives, campaigns, and whatnot at UIW. And is it really, I don't know, I guess I'm trying to pull from different experiences to understand this, the role that you have. But I listened to, in a masterclass course, Bob Iger was talking about stuff that he's done at Disney. And it seems like there's a little bit of like the creativity in your role comes from identifying opportunities that exist out in the world, or like, you know, a pile of resources from a philanthropist or an entity, a business, another school, different country, and trying to find ways to align, you know, someone that has a desire to impact the world with a teacher or a executive at the college that is wanting to also go achieve something. And so it's almost like you're a deal maker, and I don't know, and that's kind of what Bob Iger was talking about, is that his deal making is a key piece of his role as a CEO of Disney. Not that you that's directly analogous, because it sounds like you maybe don't have like you can't do anything at any time. There's more of that consultative decision making or whatnot. But yeah, I don't know if that is there anything in that that am I like on the right trail, or do you would you tweak what I'm just how I'm describing that?
No, I think you described it really well. I think that, you know, one of the things you do have to be excited yourself and have that enthusiasm. And certainly both at Carroll in Montana and here in San Antonio at the University of Incarnate Word, there are amazing opportunities that are based on location, that both places have things that others don't have. And, you know, how do you take advantage of that? But you have to match. You're matching people and resources in a lot of ways. So you have to get to know a lot of people. So in our case, you know, trying to get to know everyone across the campus is challenging, but really understanding, you know, who has what interest and then matching that up, especially when it's when you're trying to raise money, you know, philanthropy, and matching those resources to institutional desire and those that are in the institution and what they're wanting to do, whether it's research, special programs, is definitely the case. So, you know, sometimes not necessarily you're not necessarily making a deal as much as you are just matching, and you're matching people's, you know, mutual desires to see certain things happen and to see some outcomes. And of course, you know, people, it's very easy for them to get excited about education and all the possibilities with transforming young lives and even those that are maybe not as young into helping them achieve their dreams. You know, is very exciting for most people, and so to be able to channel that excitement and enthusiasm and allow people to really have the opportunity to be matched with someone who shares their interests and desires and enthusiasm is really it's a really rewarding experience. But it does take it means that you have to be in a lot of places to understand what those opportunities are. So whether that's within the city or state or nationally or maybe even internationally, and then understanding what's happening within your own learning community and what's happening within the broader communities is really important to make the match.
Mm. What has surprised you in your career as president in your entire career in higher education? What has surprised you the most?
You know, I think some of the things that surprise me shouldn't actually be surprising, and yet they still are. And I think that is the power of one individual, one that one may have in a teaching and learning environment, of really influencing someone's life to an amazing extent. You know, you think about individuals, and I've heard this at almost every institution that I've been to, that when people talk about their experiences in college, they oftentimes don't talk in terms of their life being necessarily enriched or, you know, this helped me. They actually talk about such transformation that they'll use the word life saving. And you think, what does that really mean? You know, life saving. You've probably heard me say this before. It's like, you know, these are not individuals that were at risk of death, but they were at risk of not having as fulfilling and enriched life as they had as a result of being at a certain institution and interacting with certain people that truly transformed them and made them into who they are. And without that, they think, what would have happened to me? And I am still amazed. I am still surprised at how many times I hear people talk in those terms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really, so the other surprising thing, I guess, on that is not necessarily something that's happening within higher education, but outside of higher education, which is the, you know, the lack of value that some seem to place on higher education. You know, is it worth it? What is really the value? And yet when you know what happens as a result of people's time at an institution and you see that transformation and they talk in terms of life-saving experiences, you know, to know that they just would not have had such a fulfilling and enriched life if it weren't for having gone to the institution and met the people that they met and learned from them, that they wouldn't be who they are. And so I think you, the unbelievable value in that is placed. So that's something that still surprises me, is that we're still sometimes needing to justify and argue the value of higher education. That's still surprising to me.
That actually kind of ties in with my thought of, I have discussed many times with different people of the future of college. So it's like, I got an engineering degree and then I worked in engineering for 6 months and then I went in a totally different field, right? So on one hand, someone could be like, oh, you wasted your time, right? But in the process of going to the particular college that I went to, which I think, again, the particular school, just going to college, like college and college, it's not equal, right? There's obviously a difference. I really appreciated the liberal arts education at Carroll. Gave me an opportunity to do a lot of different things that I probably would have had I gone to a very narrow, like engineering school, for example. But the other thing that I've thought about is with the advent of technology and all this e-learning and YouTube and the cost of college going up, I'm curious what you see as the future of higher education at a broader, like across the country or potentially the world, but I would say focusing on the U.S. Like, what is college going to look like in 10 years? Because I have my, I'll own it and say, like, pessimistic view from the outside of just like people that I've met that didn't go to, say, Carroll College or potentially similar for UIW, that got these massively expensive degrees and then they're now, you know, working in a job that they could have theoretically gotten right out of high school. And I don't know if that's just a coincidence and not tied to the direction that the future's going, but I'm curious, you're obviously in a much more broad and deeper knowledge of that space.
Chris, you bring up a lot of good points in that, and just what's maybe seemingly one question, but when I think about the experiences that you had at Carroll and that you were in engineering and then determined that engineering wasn't where you wanted to be, but you shifted into many different things, but things that you had interest in while you were at Carroll College. So it may not have been your major, but you were still doing things and working with items. I mean, even I remember the drones, and you were an early adapter of autonomous vehicular systems, which we have a lot of it at the University of Incarnate Word, and are doing amazing things even to take a look at power lines so that people don't have to go up on the poles. And so I think about how, you know, I was learning from you a lot of things at that time with what you were doing in multimedia and the experiences and the way that you were capturing things. that I think you also were able to grow in those experiences. But I'm sure that now, even though you're not directly involved in engineering, you're probably applying critical thinking skills that came out of your study of engineering on a daily basis in many different ways. So I never really think about, you know, I think it's easy to think very discipline specific, and okay, if you're not in a discipline, then that time, I mean, some people might think that that's wasted, but I really think of that kind of learning as the ability to take what you learned and how you learned it in a way that that really allows you to think differently and to think critically about different situations. You know, I was a language major, and I sometimes use Japanese still, but I think that the experiences that I had in learning language actually helped me to think differently about other things, because you are constantly having to think, what word am I using? How do I work around it? Even if you don't know maybe the exact word, you're trying to work around things too in order to communicate in some level. So I always think of what happens in that environment as being of incredible value. So you also bring up, you know, the point of some people who maybe they graduate, have a lot of debt, they're not really working in a field that would require a bachelor's degree. And that is unfortunate when that happens. But I also think, you know, there are so many different institutions. So many different types of institutions, really different sizes, different locations. I mean, so when we talk about higher education, you know, colleges and universities, we oftentimes really, you know, it's easy to try to say this is higher education. This is what college and university life is like. But really, they're varied. And when I think about also how teaching and learning has changed over the years, it's changed a lot since you and I were at Carroll College together. And it certainly has changed a lot since I was an undergraduate. I mean, I got an email account, I think, my senior year. And, you know, when I think about just the technological advances and now I think about how we're all the different delivery methods. And it's not just use of technology, but, you know, the pandemic, I think, was a very interesting illustration of how, you know, things changed. And imagine if we hadn't had the tools already employed in a way that where teaching and learning was taking place online or in a or in a hybrid manner. And so we took that at the University of Incarnate Word and actually made that into we were creating courses that were using faculty and students mixed in the classrooms online classrooms in Mexico and in the United States, putting them together in a bilingual, bicultural manner, even doing social justice related work for, in this case, the Chichimeca people in the region that we were in Mexico. So there was entrepreneurship, you know, language, social justice, economics. I mean, there were so many different things that were being employed in the disciplines, but also a really unique environment in which that teaching and learning occurred. You know, and then to think about the different types of, you know, whether it's professional education, short courses, certifications, badges, MOOCs. I mean, there have been a lot of different changes in higher education and in delivery methods, length of time, ways of learning. So I think that there have been a lot of changes that are maybe really unrecognized in higher education, because we still think, well, people are going into a classroom and they still have to take 120 hours in order to get a bachelor's degree and those kinds of things don't, I mean, that's still available. But then you think about all the different ways that education is actually accelerated, or, you know, ways that people say education should be free. Well, you can find lots of examples where education is free. Some of it may not be for a degree, but some of it actually is, depending on your economic situation. Promise programs, HOPE programs. There are a lot of different avenues in which one can attain a degree, and they may not know of all the different types of institutions and ways to do it, but you can probably find something that you want. So when people talk about, you know, the future of higher education, you know, will it be around? Will it be around in the same way? I think for sure it's going to be around, and there will be methods in which it is the same. There will be that will be there, but there are already so many ways in which it's not. And I think one thing that's really interesting that that I think sometimes we don't keep in mind is there is actually a very good reason for schooling happening at the time and in the manner that it happens along the normal course of the trajectory of human growth and development. So and human growth and development is really unlikely to change. It's gestation periods, for example, have not really changed. It's 9 months. I mean, sometimes it's sooner, sometimes it's later, but usually it's 9 months. And the same is true of all of human growth and development. We may have great advances in medicine that will help us, especially in the aging process. But primary education, secondary education, college, the different segmentations are really, in a way, designed for along that trajectory of human growth and development. So when we think about the university time, that time between generally 17 and 22 years old, somewhere in there, I mean, we know what happens physically, we know development, we even know about the development of the brain, right? The frontal lobe, when it's finally developed, and apparently much later for men than women, as we know. So, there's a great time and place when you think about the independence that 17 to 22 year olds gain for the first time. And in some ways, it's like not quite ready for prime time, but really getting close. So, what a great time to be formed, to really form on your own independently and away, typically away from home for the first time, but not completely outside of someone's care and the care of others within that learning community, to continue to grow and develop and to form values at probably what is the most critical time in a person's life. So again, when you think about what kind of institution you might choose and that you want to go to, I mean, you probably very deliberately chose an institution like Carroll because not only because of the academic disciplines, but because of the community that it is and the values that are there. And I think we see that at so many levels at the University of Incarnate Word. We see that in our medical school, which is very specific. Our School of Optometry is the only school that is at a faith-based institution in the country right now. And a lot of times when we ask, why did you choose this School of Optometry over others, that actually factors into it. And so sometimes it's service. They want to do service to others. Sometimes they like the pedagogy, and the pedagogy is also very, it can be very community-based, especially at our School of Osteopathic Medicine. So they're attracted to things that align with the values and the mission of the institution. So I think there's that too. And then sometimes when I think of graduates, it's, where did you go? What did you learn? How did that align? And I have actually yesterday and the day before spent time at some local high schools and was actually talking to them very, very specifically about college choice and about the need to try to find places that you can feel at home, that is community-based, where you get a certain amount of support and that aligns with your values. And so I think sometimes, maybe many don't get that opportunity or they don't get the right match. And I wonder what that is doing in the growth and development and the help to even then turn to, a place of employment. Internships.
Right. Totally. So internships is the thing I was thinking about is I look at my opinion of the future of college is that it's going like technology and online learning is going to be heavily integrated in some fashion, maybe to get like prerequisites out of the way or something, or spread the access to education further than we can currently. But the thing that I have a hard time understanding how you replace the value of is the same thing that you can't really replace the value of when you attend a conference for something. So it's like there's, South by Southwest or CES or all these major, any industry conference that you go to, I would argue the reason that I would attend them and tell anybody to attend them is to be in the room with a bunch of like-minded people for the opportunity to network and build connections with people in a way that is very difficult to do remotely or online. There's like people are trying to mimic it. But at the end of the day, it's like the real value. And I agree that Carol, I 100% like, I am an engineer right now. I always was, probably before. Like, I think in spreadsheets, everything's an equation to optimize. And I got to improve that skill while I was at college, but I also got the opportunity to connect with a lot of professors, alumni, and I still leverage those relationships to meet and introduce people, and there's like the community, and I agree with the values thing as well, because you can be in a room or be at a school with people that share the same values. I do think that some people don't realize that. I had a number of friends that attended, you know, public universities, and I don't know if they thought much about like where they were attending or why they were attending school at all until they were in their sixth year and then finally graduating and were like, wait, what did I just do? Or why did I come here? What was the purpose of this? And luckily, I've had parents that guided me in trying to decipher that when I was making my decision. But yeah, I just feel like the one thing that college is still going to be valuable for is that connections, like building your network, if you want to take advantage of it. There's obviously going to be a lot of people that attend and are oblivious to that value. But yeah, but I wonder what like Gabe and Ellie and Cecilia, are they going to, like, what is that going to look like? And I think it's going to look a lot different, but there's still going to be a period between 17 and 22 where there's a lot of learning. You're venturing off on your own, and heavily augmented with technology in some way.
Yeah, and Chris, I think the augmentation of technology can then help expand and the opportunities for the real human interaction and dialogue that may not even be like-minded. It may be very differently minded that engages in really rich dialogue and discussion that, you know, sometimes is lacking in our society right now, but
totally.
We need more of that. We need more civil dialogue, and we need to be practiced at that and understand how that happens. And the classroom's a great place for that to happen. So a lot of what I think we've been seeing for certain with technology, you know, initially, even after the advent of online learning, we were talking about the flipped classroom. And within that flipped classroom, and the idea was that there's so much work that you can do before you get to the classroom, so that when you are in the classroom, you're not spending the time doing things that you can now be doing outside of the classroom, so that you can engage in that kind of dialogue. So yeah. One of the, you know, when we came back from a break, from summer going into fall, and we're still talking about the effects of the pandemic and talking about being online. And it was really interesting to hear some of our own faculty talk about how with the teaching and learning that was taking place during the pandemic and even after, you know, we're still in the pandemic, but post being completely online.
Shut down, yeah.
You know, they were talking about this, really feeling the transition, and it sounds kind of crass, but from being a sage on a stage to the guide on the side. And really learning alongside the students, and the great value that there was in that, and that there was probably even more learning taking place in the classroom because of that, and because there was probably more flipping of the classroom, and there was more exploration that was taking place. And you know, and then Chris, it's not just, of course, it's your classmates and colleagues, but it's also that interaction with the professor that you have, you know, for the rest of your life, who somehow has impacted. And we saw that at Carroll. I saw that you had Kyle Strode on your, you know, chemistry, and you were engineering, and
yeah,
but you're still tied to this chemistry professor that I don't know how many years Kyle Strode has been at Carroll, but it may be, you know, decades worth of individuals who have been
trained. Oh, yeah.
And he probably knows every single one of them.
Mm-hmm. No, and he was one of the best teachers that I've ever had. And I was talking to him about how there's still analogies that he would use in chemistry that I've used when we're trying to analyze the number of leads that we need for the contractor business that I'm the marketing director for. It's just like, there are certain things that you know, problem solving or pattern recognition or whatever you want to call it, those various things that are, it just like broadens your ability to identify or think about things. That's like, yeah, the more ways that you can do that with a variety of classes or, you know, a major, minor, or double major, you know, like all those things, the liberal arts education, again, just like, had I gone somewhere else and just done exactly what I needed to get the skills that I needed to be an engineer, I would not be as good off as I am now.
Yeah, you know? Perfect example. A perfect example of how chemistry helps marketing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Even though you may not think it was, so was that, exactly. Was that, you're not doing chemistry, so was the chemistry class wasted? No, not at all.
No.
You're applying that learning. You're really applying the critical thinking skills that you learned in chemistry to another discipline.
100%, yep. So I'm curious, jumping into like your, I don't know if psyche is the right word, but I've been obsessing over like personal and primary aim. I've also heard it described as like a vivid vision, but I'm interested to the level that you're comfortable sharing. Like, what is your purpose? What is your primary aim? Why are you? You know, you said those three things, the absorbing chaos, inspiring confidence, and restoring order. Like, why are you enduring that as opposed to, you know, any of the other things that you could apply your stamina and perseverance to? Why do you do what you do, and what is your goal 3 years, 5 years, whatever timeline in the horizon?
I love when students have an opportunity to do something that they never thought that they would be able to do in their lives. And when I know that that is the case, and when I hear that, it makes anything and everything worthwhile. And so I think of it as very much a vocation. And I probably, you know, say too much about, you know, absorbing the chaos. I mean, you know, sometimes the chaos can be in the thrill of an athletic victory, or it could be by, you know, winning or receiving some amazing grant for research. I mean, there are so many things that are just, that are, you know, wildly chaotic but wonderful. Not that it's negative, but you know, I think of these, the experiences of students in higher education from undergraduate all the way through professional school, doctoral students. You know, some of the most emotional moments I've seen in people's lives are crossing the stage from the sense of accomplishment. But it's also when you hear someone say, I went on a medical mission trip to Oaxaca, Mexico, and I can't believe what I learned there. I can't believe I went there. I've never been out of San Antonio before. You know, in Montana, maybe it was never being out of Montana. But then to have the ability to study abroad or to do some kind of amazing, you know, mission work that they never thought they'd have the ability to do, studying things that they never thought they would be studying, having the opportunity to enter a profession that they never thought they would be able to. I mean, I had a really profound experience with one of our students just before commencement. We were having a celebration, and a student came up to me and she said, you know, as president, I just have to tell you my story, and I have to tell you how incredibly grateful I am for the faculty that taught me. And she started crying, and she started naming all of the faculty that taught her and what they did for her. And she said, you know, I was homeless at one point, and now I'm going to be a math teacher. And that, I mean, that is, so when you experience that kind of vocationally, you just think, I want more people to have that experience. I want more people to come and be transformed and to do things and be the people that they never, that in their wildest dreams, maybe they never even thought that they could become. And it can happen, really quickly, but it's profound for them, but also for me as a professional to think, okay, what do I need to do at this institution? How do I need to support faculty? What new programs do we need to create? What new opportunities to do research, to study abroad, to have an internship, to experience some kind of mentorship? What can we do? And, you know, for me, that happened at a pretty, you know, at an early age. You know, I know that you know that I went abroad. I was very fortunate to be able to go abroad to Japan when I was still pretty young. I was a sophomore in high school and went and lived with a family that didn't speak any English and went to school for 13 months. And it was life changing for me, both in the way that I think it changed my perspectives and also the way that I could navigate the world in a way of, you know, talk about, you know, learning how to navigate in uncertain situations. You don't know where you are, you can't read anything, and you still have to get around. So that's really helpful. And I think, okay, how do we help others have that kind of transformational experience where maybe it changes their perspective, maybe it changes their life trajectory, maybe it just helps them to understand how to work in, you work through ambiguity, uncertain, unfamiliar circumstances and overcome them and make things better for themselves, but also for their families, for their communities, and then how that extends out. And so, you know, I'm very privileged to be able to hear the stories of transformation because the people relay them to the president when they might, you know, this student might not have gone up to anyone else and started saying, but she needed to tell her story and in a way with great gratitude to say, I need to thank these people in a group to someone. And so I get to hear that. And it inspires me. It inspires me from the standpoint of really being vocation.
So you have always been very good at storytelling, like the story that you're sharing now, to illustrate an answer or a point, which I look at as I'm just going to go down my engineering, like reverse engineer how someone does this or becomes good at this, right? But I'm wondering, like, for someone that, and you know, I'm on the senior leadership team at the company I work for, and there's a number of us on there. We all have, you know, exciting growth. I mean, the business has exciting growth plans, and it's going to require all of us, including myself, to become better leaders. And my perspective right now, and talking to people and analyzing what happens as you move up and start managing higher level leaders themselves, you know, there's less like management of those people and more inspiring and like vision setting and guiding and truly leading, as opposed to a leader of like as a manager in a business where it's like make sure things don't break and fall apart and keep people on task. It's less and less a part of the role as you move up. And I'm curious where, like, I'm sure you have aspirations or skills or things that you identify in yourself that you want to work on or improve. Where do you turn to improve yourself, or have you over the years? Is it like, you know, reading books, talking to people? Do you like watch shows and movies and like reflect on that? Or I'm just curious, what's your strategy, or what would be your recommendation to improve as a leader?
First, I had to smile when you were talking about storytelling, because one of the things that we also say about college and university presidents is that they are storyteller in chief. And you're right. I like to tell the stories of the success and again transformation that happens at the university. And it's
so much more powerful, yeah, than being like, we changed people's lives. It's just like in movies, right? If you want to move somebody, tell the story of an individual and go deep and explain the before and after character transformation. You're going to do much better than saying there's so many students there are some students that are homeless and now they're teachers. Like, it just, that doesn't have the same impact as telling the story of an individual, right? And you know that, and you leverage that very well. And that's, I'm like impressed and also like an admirer of that skill.
Well, I appreciate that.
Because it's not telling someone exactly what they need. One of my favorite quotes in storytelling, it was one of the directors at Pixar says that you should never give people their whole meal. People actually like to work for their meal. Mm-hmm. They want to solve the puzzle. So they say, we always give people 2 + 2. We never give them 4. And I feel like there is a piece of that when you're communicating something to somebody about, like, so why should I send my kid to college? And it's kind of like, I'm not going to answer that question for you, but let me tell you a story. Yeah. And you can answer it yourself. You know what I mean?
And you can tell story after story after story in that case. That's a really good point. So thanks for bringing that up, because I think that is a, you know, that is a big role with the president. When you're first questioning, what does a president do? I'd forgotten about storyteller in chief. But maybe along those same lines, I like reading biographies. I like reading autobiographies. I like hearing people tell their own stories in a lot of ways. And there's usually something you can learn from them. I find that you learn a lot about perseverance, people overcoming obstacles, continuing until they, you know, reach success. But there are also really folks who have enough of an interesting story of their lives to tell it. You know, it's really fascinating to learn of people's trajectories. So I guess maybe as being someone who's very interested in other people, I like hearing other people's stories. So I do tend to gravitate toward them when I'm reading books. I have colleagues, there are different types of meetings. I mean, for me, the Council of Independent Colleges is a private institution, Association of Catholic Colleges and Universities. Another that when we get together, you know, presidents do share their stories to learn from each other. And I'll tell you, I had a really heartbreaking call, not that you at the beginning of the term, from another president who was experiencing a suicide on campus. And she called me at 1 a.m. And she said, you know, so here's what I'm thinking. What do you think I need to do? And I said, I think you know what you need to do. And here's what you need to do. And she said, yeah, I know. I just wanted to connect with you and hear from you. Mm. So, you know, we lean on each other in really interesting ways. Even sometimes when it's just to hear, you know, someone's voice when you're experiencing a really tough time, which, you know, those are, an experience like that is, you know, that's the worst type of experience, I think, for a college or university president or anyone experiencing that, families, friends, colleagues. I mean, it's just horrible. And it's something I think right now, you know, during the pandemic, I think everyone has on their minds, you know, mental health and helping others. But you lean on your colleagues in those situations. I also have, I was fortunate to belong to Young Presidents Organization. I'm not so young anymore as I was when I joined, but you can continue on even when you're what they call gold. The joke being that the G is silent and you're a little bit older. But those groups they're confidential groups of individuals who are at a certain place and point in their lives. And I have found that to be really helpful to be able to have people that you can talk to in confidence. And they're not necessarily designed to give you advice, but very often the way that you're kind of taught to respond within the group like that is to say, that reminds me of a time. You know, so that somebody else is telling their story and maybe how they work through it. So those are helpful. I like to read. The pandemic has been much more difficult for me to find as much time as I once did in trying to read for professional development. But there are also conferences. I've gone to three different Harvard School of Education, you know, kind of longer period and very high quality. And again, I'm very fortunate that I've been able to do those kinds of things. But I think there are many different avenues to do that, and especially in higher education at virtually every level. And some of those are regionally based of organizations for like that will pull together people with similar responsibilities or titles. And I think those are really good to build your group of friends and colleagues across other institutions that you can pick up the phone and call and say, you know, how do you deal with this?
Mm. Do you have, or maybe it's in those groups, or maybe a coach that helps you identify blind spots or find out, like, ooh, this is something that I may not realize about myself that I'm doing or I'm lacking, or I could, I need it. Maybe I've always been, or my more recent thought is, knowing your blind spots is not so you can change all of them or improve them. You just need to know they exist so that they're not unintentionally hampering your ability to lead. Is that something that happens in those groups, or do you have like a personal coach? Or obviously, yeah. I think a spouse is a great person for that. But yeah,
the group that I spoke of earlier does that. As you know, my wife Lisa is terrific, it's so amazing to have the support of a loving spouse in a role like this, and also who's probably the person who really understands the role that you're in better than anybody else, because they're really witnessing it day in, day out, and they hear, you know, about it. And it is kind of, you know, first thing in the morning to the last thing before going to sleep at night. And so that's really important. I did have a kind of coach. I mean, I would say it probably was when I first joined Carol, the board kept on a kind of a retainer, the search consultant, because she was a very successful president in the Northwest. And it was really just someone to be able to call on it at any time, kind of for anything.
Just talk through stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and in my first year, I did quite frequently pick up the phone and say, I'm experiencing this, what would you do with that? How do you think I should handle something? Have you experienced this before? And for my first year in a presidency, that was very helpful. And I'm grateful that the board did that for me. And they had the insight to do that. It was also from a board member at Carol that said, you need to join this organization. I'm going to tell them about you and nominate you. It's because you're of a certain age and this is what it's designed for, and it's going to be really helpful for you. So that's actually how I got in.
That's awesome.
Into a YPO as well, which is another, that's actually, you know, it's right in front of me, right? Is the Board of Trustees. Your Board of Trustees is amazing. I was on the phone with the chair of our Board of Trustees just 2 hours ago, and it was touching base and is someone to talk to. Trustees, interestingly, they actually, you know, I know that sometimes people think of them as as the boss, and because they do hire and they can terminate a presidency, and they're the ones who handle your contract, but they're really your supporters, and you get to know them very well, and you can also have very good relationships with them. And that was actually something that was said to me by my mentor as I was going off into a presidency. He said, don't forget, or you know, keep in mind that the board, you're going to be really, really close to these board members, and you know, they should have your back. They've got your back. That's what they're designed to do, and the institution, of course, but they're there to help and support as well. And so they've been very helpful too in different situations, even in kind of getting to know the lay of the land somewhere in a new location. Very helpful.
Totally. Got a couple last questions here as we wrap up our time. So what are you most proud of in your career / life at this point?
This gets back to kind of an earlier statement that I've had, is when I can have a lot of pride when I read about or hear about a student who says, this is what I've done, and it was something that you helped create. Maybe it was something that you actually came up with as an idea. Maybe it was something that you supported. You remember the socks at Carroll, right? Over the city socks.
The Skyline socks,
Skyline
or whatever.
Socks.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that came out of the entrepreneurship program that was started by it was an idea that I had, and as we were working with other, with different faculty members who were entrepreneurs in residence for a year at a time. And I think that group was working with John McCarville, who was over Crocs at that time. Mm-hmm. And you know, so he knew all about how to create and distribute with this group of students who were working with Skyline Sox. So it was literally years later that I heard from one of the students, you know, who was reaching out and saying, hey, here's what's going on right now, and here's what's happening with, you know,
from this idea that started back,
you know. And those are the moments that to me is just like, wow, I had a hand in creating it, and it made a difference in this student's life, and they learned something great, and they're doing something really interesting with it. So those are the moments that for me are the ones that I'm most proud of. Or somebody who's just come back from an exchange program that you helped create and is telling you everything that they were able to do in another country. Those are amazing.
That's awesome.
Right? That's when I'm very proud of the work.
So what are book recommendations? You can give me your favorite all-time book, your three most recent, top five, whatever you want.
Okay. So I was leader on a from a leadership standpoint, I would say Stephen Samples, The Contrarian's Guide to Leadership, is fantastic. I've read it many times. I've passed it along to people. He's a leadership professor. He was president of the University of Southern California, and I think it's a terrific book. Bowman and Deal's Reframing Organizations. You know, if you think about can leadership be learned, I think yeah, it can. But you know, it's easier when you have references of framework. And if you can kind of frame things and think about, okay, now I need to, I've got an issue, or I've got, you know, dilemma, or I'm trying to do something new, and how do I look at it? And so to the different ways that you need to look at things, because most people reside in a certain area where they have strengths, like a storyteller. So a lot of my strength, I know, is in this symbolic framework. And so, you know, making sure that I'm not neglecting the other important frameworks that I need to look at in different lenses. Great book. I love Japanese literature, and Murakami Haruki, Haruki Murakami, is one of my favorites. So just almost from a standpoint of just kind of an escapism, because it's very much a kind of a postmodern reality in his writing, I've always really enjoyed it. So for me, a recommended author is a Japanese author, Murakami Haruki.
Is the book in English also?
Yes, everything is translated. Okay. And now it's immediately translated. When I first started reading him, and I met him and had a, it's another story, but when I was at the University of Texas, and one of our professors knew him well and brought him in, and I got to have lunch with him. And it, you talk about getting to have lunch with your favorite author was just...
That's awesome.
Just amazing.
Okay, favorite movie?
Oh, I have probably seen the movie Good Will Hunting more times than is probably healthy, because every time it seems to, if I'm flipping channels and it's there, I just get stuck on it or on an airplane. I love that movie.
That is a great one. And how can people connect with you if they want to follow you, see what you're up to, send you a message?
Right now, I think LinkedIn has been great for me to connect. So if they search for me, there's a lot of postings there. They can certainly find me on the UIW website to contact me. I've found LinkedIn to be really a great way to connect with people, even people you don't know who share an interest, or they want to touch base and kind of keep track of what's happening in higher education or in your world.
Totally. Well, I will make sure to put that in the show notes. And Dr. Evans, again, I know that you're a very, very busy man, so I was greatly honored that you said, okay, I can give you an hour to chat, because it was good to catch up and pick your brain on leadership and higher education. So thank you very much.
Next time I'm going to be interviewing you to find out what's going on in your life and hear about what's really going on with Natalie and the kids and all the amazing things, because it's just been way too long. And I'm really glad that we have this opportunity to connect, but we need to connect on a more personal level soon.
Totally. Well, you let me know. It could be a couple of years from now, but I know you're doing great things, and I'm excited to see where you take UIW. So have a good one.
Thank you, Chris. You too. Have a Merry Christmas.